COVIDity. The COVID gonna get me. If not now, it will. The COVID gonna kill me. Find me where I live. Buried under covers, sheltered in the hall, trading goodbyes to all my friends through goddamn 15-foot walls. The COVID'll get me. Get me bad. My lungs are weak, and I am much misunderstood. I practice social distance, even got an oversized mask. Feel like the Lone Ranger just before he got the clap. The COVID gonna find me. If not today, in time. The COVID after me. Find exactly where I am. Call it social distance. I call it pain in the soul. You say I can handle it, but it's too heavy a load. The COVID round the corner will thrash me till I blew. But that's not my worry. Terrified for you. You've always been distant, but not for me. Now I feel you drifting like you're far out at sea. The COVID gonna get me, if not now, any day. The COVID got my number, knows just where I stay. You say I'll manage social distance, that I can make it work. But if I'm distant from you, I'm sunk before I swum. The COVID gonna get me, if not now, soon. The COVID has me up all night, fighting against all this gloom. Too much death surrounding. I darn near given up. Keep calling on the telephone, but you're hung up on Skype. The COVID coming, sure to get us good. Our lungs are weak, and we are much misunderstood.
Good evening, comrades, and welcome to Poet Radio. My name is Chris, host of this monthly program on WGXC. My guest on this occasion, April 2021, is Charles Bernstein, whose poem COVIDity you've just heard at the top of the show. Charles Bernstein is a poet and a critic. He's author of numerous books, a professor of emeritus of English and comparative literature at the University of Pennsylvania. In 2019, he was awarded the Bollingen Prize for Poetry, which is pretty much the most prestigious award given to poets in the U.S. I met Charles nearly 30 years ago when he was a professor in the SUNY Buffalo Poetics Program, where, along with Robert Creeley and Susan Howe, he developed a major center for the study of modern and contemporary poetry. Greatly admired how he has supported not only students over the years, but has cultivated resources for the global poetry and poetics community through initiatives such as the Electronic Poetry Center and Penn Sound, which is an archive at UPenn that holds the world's largest collection of poets reading their own poems. Charles and I have been discussing having a radio session together prior to the pandemic, but in the months leading up to last March, he was traveling extensively, so it's happening now. It's an honor to have him on the program during National Poetry Month. Welcome, Charles.
It's good to be here, Chris.
I remember you had some, didn't you have a poem for National Poetry Month?
Yes, against National Poetry Month as such, which is easily available. And even a little excerpt was on National Public Radio.
Well, theoretically, we could discuss many topics we both have interests in, but the plan today is to focus on your new book, Topsy Turvy, which is coming out later this month through the University of Chicago Press. Topsy Turvy seems like a perfect title for a book of poems that appears after the past year. So I'm glad to have a chance to discuss it with you and share some of it with our audience. I noticed the word COVIDity has a Urban Dictionary entry, but otherwise seems like one of those neologisms and anyone can comprehend. Why don't you tell us about your form of the poem here? It's a type of blues, right?
Yep, I guess. I wasn't, you know, I mean, as in so many cases in this book, there are forms that are echoed, but I'm not really trying to write in any form. But certainly that has the blues song quality to it, but it's a little whacked out even for a very open form like the blues. And it's a poem rather than something meant to be sung as well. So that's one of the later poems in the book. The book is mostly written, you know, before we got hit by COVID. And I put it together really in the first month of our lockdown when I thought in a kind of desperate way to create something that would be very intense to do as I was home, and also just trying to put my affairs, or anyway, poems in order. So I came up with this book, which I probably wouldn't have done for 6 months or a year later. And Chicago put it out pretty fast. So COVIDity is one of the last ones. As far as I know, I made up that word COVIDity and wanted to evoke the paranoia and wildness and craziness, and also ecstatic aspects, but also to, you know, as was often in my work, to keep it comic, because often as you get closer and closer to a self-conscious bathos, it is comic and scary too. I mean, I think you hear that poem, you know, it's real. Like Robert Creeley used to say, it's real. I mean, as if the fear is real. And certainly, as an older person, I felt, you know, in some danger, because I was in Brooklyn at that time. It was a very, as you all remember, a lot of people dying in New York City in March and April of last year. Worst ever in my lifetime as far as that goes. So
it's crazy, yeah.
You know, now we see, you know, what the story was, of course, and the people who often bear the brunt of the violence and poverty and incarceration in the U.S. also bore the brunt of sickness and death in this crisis. So I'm aware of that too. Just the ability to stay home. And I was retired too, was of course protected me.
Yeah, we were really lucky you got to do all that traveling right beforehand, right?
Yeah, I did an enormous amount of traveling in the year before, because just after I retired too, I had that time free. So I was in Europe and Asia, and that was great. And I miss the traveling, and I miss talking to people and seeing people one-on-one, much less stopping to teach, which I did at a good time, in the sense that I avoided the compensations that have to be made at this time. You know, I don't know what to say about
COVIDity.
About COVIDity, apart from that, it was translated by my friend Feng Yi in China, and she asked me a lot of questions about it, and she didn't know what the Lone Ranger reference was, so I had to explain that to her. But then it turned out that the then president also spoke of masks and the Lone Ranger, and that she noticed that in China, that this reference was made to masks. But of course, it's a different kind of mask.
Right.
But that's the kind of lexical dyspraxia or inversion that I often practice in my poems, where I flip things around, you know, like a face mask for an eye mask that you'd use to hide your identity. I like those kinds of switches.
I noticed that many of the poems are written prior to the pandemic, but the Topsy Turvy just seems like a great title to have as the collection. We've all felt this topsy-turviness is a sort of instability.
I ended up, you know, having a title for each section, too. So they really, it's four books, and then the overall title, Topsy-Turvy, of which there are many echoes and references, you know, to that term, topsy-turvy, things upside down. But one of the things, like I'm saying about actually the two masks, is also upside down. I mean, I have a kind of I used to call it dyslexia, but now I have a fancier, more accurate way of describing it as as a spatial and lexical dyspraxia. I invert things all the time. I go right for left, and I say the wrong name. In fact, two people's names are in mind. I write the wrong name. Many people do something along this line. It really interests me. Don't like it when I'm driving and I go the wrong way, but I am interested in it from the point of view of poetry. So the topsy-turvy is in a sense very accurate to my praxis. And even the blues form in that poem, Covidity, is kind of topsy-turvy. It's turned backward. It doesn't have it has almost like the reverse, something like the reverse structure of a blues lyric.
And then that was from you said it was one of the later poems. Indeed, that's from the last book of the book, which is Last Kind Words. What I'd like to do is we're going to kind of trace backwards through the book. I've made some selections of the poems in the book, and there's a recording that you have produced, self-produced, which is now, I guess, out on, you told me it's on the Chicago Press
so
website.
For one thing, the order in the book is not the order I wrote things. So there's a poem called Shelter in Place in the first section that was also kind of post-March of 2020. There's like maybe, I think there's only two or three poems that were written after March when the serious COVID crisis became apparent. I wanted to make a kind of a weaving and song really with that ordering going back and forth in time.
There were other, I've been asking this to other guests on the program, is if there were other like immersions or activities that helped you get through. I mean, I know you're a busy writer.
Well, I don't know if I did get through.
Okay, I hear
that. I survived. The audiobook, also, of course, I recorded during this time, and I took that as an interesting project. Chicago hadn't really done audiobooks before I proposed it for Near Miss, and I said, you know, let's do it. And it was an interesting thing to record the books straight through. I liked recording at home. The gives me a lot of control of what I'm doing. It's more like writing. And Chicago distributes it through its website, and then eventually it'll be available also through Audible.com and Amazon, because that's just they pick it up as part of the distribution. So while right now the book is not out, is listed on the Chicago site, and eventually the audiobook will come up on those other sites that people are used to with audiobooks, who are, you know, mostly not an audience that listens to poetry. It's an interesting thing for you and me, who are so focused on poetry as an art of listening and the recording of poetry. But the biggest market for audio recordings of single people reading is, of course, not poets reading their own work. Not that we don't have a lot of people listening to Penn Sound, which is, after all, free. My favorite part of the whole Near Miss, the first one, I'm going to do a version of it for you. This will be live on tape, but I think the very best thing about the audiobook was the following. It was the first thing you hear. Near Miss, read by the author. I just really love that little opening credit there.
Especially with a title like that. This is very good.
Read by the author is a very important tagline.
Yeah, true. And so let's move on. We're going to play this poem. It got my attention, Poetic Citizenship and Negative mm-hmm. Dialectics. So here's that.
Poetic Citizenship and Negative Dialectics. Poetry is best that governs least. No, it isn't. Poetry and citizenship are inconsolably incommensurable, conjoined at the heart, but beating time to different drummers. From time to time, aesthetic justice is symbolic and dwells next to, not in, the world of political action. Give me a break. The politics of poetic form is averse to the form of political prose. In your dreams. The kind of poetry I want is precarious, extreme. The kind of citizenship I want is neither. As if you can have it both ways. Accessibility is to prose what opacity is to poetry. as in a long walk is better than a short pier, the dollar value of poetry can be calculated as the square root of the sublime times the negative sum of utopia divided by the excess derivative of an originality. You wish. The kind of poetry I want questions norms of identity by rocking and roiling. It traffics in error and errancy. It's a querulous query. But that's not the only kind of poetry I want. You could fool me, buddy. When language grapples with the unfamiliar or repressed, it will more likely sound strange than familiar. The strange is pretty familiar to me. Politics speaks truth to power. Poetry speaks truth to truth. Poetry is necessarily plural. Its strands are inimical to one another. Poetry is just as vital when it is refused by public space as when it occupies public space. The question is not why discomforting poetry, to use a phrase of Tanya Foster's, doesn't have a public voice in America today, but why that voice is cast aside. The question is not, is poetry dead again, but why are you dead to poetry? Poetry is not an export produced of suffering or beauty, solidarity or despair, but a domain of freedom shrouded in veils, an inextractable aesthetic ore. Poetry is a form of lamentation, not to split cares, an expression of lamentation. Aesthetic justice turns an otherworldly eye to family, nation, community, and rationality. Poetry so conceived is of earth, not of the world. This is how poetry matters in the world. Aesthetic privilege is a negative market force, an active agent of loss. Poetry emerges from difficult life in spite of, as much as a result of. So much depends upon spite. The promise of a poem, the kind of poetry I want, is that it refuses reality. But is it good for the Jews? To be a poetic citizen is not to act as a citizen, but to perform as a poet. But there can be no citizenship without poetry. Even citizenship is symbolic. Citizenship that refuses dialogue with delirious, wanton, discomforting possibilities of poetry approaches nativism. Get off your low horse. If citizenship is the first language of the Democrat, then poetry is a second language that, out of love and deep need, refuses to obey its mother tongue. Poetry has no purpose, and that is not its purpose.
It was interesting, Charles, this poem, and in light of the blog post that I read by Jeff Hansen, which was talking about the dialectic between truth and lies that goes through the book. And so let's talk about, maybe I get you to talk a little bit about this poem, which is like a multivocal event.
So first I want to acknowledge Q. Lee, who was a professor in the City University of New York and was doing a Humanities Institute programs, and she came up with the rubric Poetic Citizenship and asked me to speak on that panel. So I wrote something about poetic citizenship. This is it's in my poetry book rather than my an essay book. I mean, I could have included it in an essay book too, but I chose to include it in topsy-turvy. It's actually a perfect poem for topsy-turvy because the poem itself is topsy-turvy. But it is closer to an essay than some most of the other pieces in there. But I think, you know, the context changes what meaning is and also the understanding of what the form is. In the early 90s, I edited a book called The Politics of Poetic Form, and that frame has been central for me. I still love that book. I think it still speaks very much to both the time it was in, but also to the present, because really The Politics of Poetic Form is talking about how poetry is political in terms of its style, diction, echoes, associations, in addition to, and to some degree apart from, and even to some degree in contradiction to, its explicit content, what the message might be. You know, this remains a point of great contest for people who are, you know, rightly suspicious of aesthetics and form and are interested in message and content and getting to the point and mottos that will galvanize people. So that's the sort of framing issue. Citizenship is fascinating because what does it mean? I would always say about, you know, that as a citizen, one has certain views that fit into what the national debate is participates as a citizen, for example, in a demonstration. Today we have another police shooting, for example, and in the wake of the George Floyd trial, so people will be out demonstrating and saying that they're expressing their grief and anger and
horror. Their right as a citizen, and
their rights as a citizen. So you know that's a primary sense of citizenship for me. So poetic citizenship wouldn't be that exactly. What would it be? I think of those things as complementary, or sometimes just different. That one's obligations as a citizen are not the same as one's work in aesthetics or as a poet. They're different things, and I partly say that not to make poetry substitute for citizenship in this other way, but also not to have poets or artists off the hook. Whatever you may do in your art can be great and can be terrible, but you still have obligations and responsibilities as a citizen that are not directly connected to that. One does not fulfill the obligation of the other. So in this particular piece, I thought to make a number of aphorisms. A lot of my work come, you know, in the last certainly 20 years consists of aphorisms, often comic, sometimes fractured, sometimes inscrutable. But, you know, some of them are, you know, are aphorisms are kind of pithy ways of looking at a situation or suggesting a way of perceiving. And I think that way, and I have, a lot of opinions and a lot of views about a number of different things. But so I want to put out some of these aphorisms, but then have a second voice, which is in italics, that would undermine and undercut the position that I was taking in the first instance. So the refrain or the second voice, it's dialogic, isn't just in dialogue in the sense of furthering and egging on, but rather in the sense of disagreeing and showing the problems with what was being asserted. So this is fundamental to my poetics, the idea of multiple and contradictory dictions, that thought and opinion can never be singularly expressed, that it exists within a complex and multiple and diverse environment.
Yeah.
And that's poetic citizenship as opposed to a univocal expression of a view, which you might have in citizenship, which is not poetic, as in demonstrating the violence has to stop, is not univocal, it's not meant to be. But in a poem, one wants to have multiple senses of even assertions like that, painful as they may be, because they enable us as citizens in the non-poetic sense to be more mobile, agile, and to understand the multiplicity of positions and how positions change in respect to who you are, where you are, and when you are. And by exploring that in a poem, what opens up to a richer consciousness and deeper affect, I would say. A lot of people would say, well, it's very abstract to do that, but I say the opposite. No, it's not. It actually has greater affect, greater emotional power rather than less. That the kind of the idea that a single strain and a single point of view and a reduced point of view is somehow more emotional certainly has never been my experience, although I'm always confronted by people saying that, but I find that that's not so much, that's kind of rigidity, and it's a kind of a coercive emotion. Whereas for me, commotion, as it opens up into sensibility and sensuousness and sensation, and therefore emotion in the sense of sensation, is a richer, deeper, and more powerful thing. Though I recognize many people disagree with me about this point.
I like the piece for a number of reasons, and it seems like a really effective strategy to avoid a dogmatism. I mean, you can say something.
Well, that's, yes. I mean, actually, there you said it better, in a way better than me. That would be a good reader's response. That's the sort of...
Okay, good.
That's what it's trying to do. Avoiding dogma is itself a dogma. So I would say, within the context of it, I often might say, avoid dogma and then undermine that, because there are multiple problems with saying that. Although I agree that that's what I'm doing. For one thing, I spent my life saying avoid dogma within the context of poetic form, that you don't have to write in one way, and that you shouldn't insist that people write in one way saying it's the best craft. This goes back to Against National Poetry Month as such. So when I say things like that, I'm typically accused of being dogmatic. And I find that always very ironic, but it's not really funny, because the people are angry. They're saying, oh, no, I'm undermining sincerity and content, and that's somehow that undermining is viewed as being dogmatic. So people who are extremely dogmatic, especially within it's funny, I don't want to continue with that phrase.
That's
especially
all right.
I was going to characterize one group or another in that respect, but this is what I would do in a poem, is to just leave that blank, leave that open, so one doesn't really know. But especially as one experiences a lot of people in the world, especially as regular people, normal people see it, and very decent people as well, they believe that their views are right, and they think that if you question the basis of the saying of those views, that you're being dogmatic, that the undermining itself is a kind of dogma. But it's not as if I don't believe that people's views are right, or that I don't have a commitment to my views. I'm looking for a deeper kind of commitment and a more open kind of commitment. So I'm not, this is what Jeff Hansen is after about truth. I'm not against truth. I'm not for lies. But I am against lies that claim the mantle of truth, or half-truths claiming the mantle of lies. Even. I think that there's a distinction you can make between truth and truthfulness. And I think sometimes truthfulness is more important than truth, and that one understands truthfulness as situational and contextual and historical, and especially embodied. It comes from a particular person in a particular way, and it isn't like scientific truth. It's invariant for all people at all times. Social truths are not invariant, but it doesn't make them not truths. And to look for social truths as if they're invariant, as if they're scientific truths, is a kind of lying, because it denies the truth of many people and the truth of their experiences, which are not always the same as yours. So one of my favorite epigraphs or aphorisms is, instead of the common speak truth to power, speak truth to truth. And this is more the spirit of this poem that we're discussing. Speak truth to truth, and not truths either, because although I always like to add an S, you never go wrong adding an S in my work, but in this case, singular. Speak truth to truth.
Well, the way you've done it is it's presenting poetry as a multiplicity, and the poem is in the third book of the book, which is called Locomotion, and it does seem to be pushing a discourse forward in a way, and it's a nice contrast to another poem in that section of that other book in the book, of the Shields Green, which I want to play now.
Shields Green. This poem has an introductory note. A poem is not a monument. But my nomination for an American hero worthy of commendation is Shields Green. Green, who had liberated himself from slavery, was 23 in 1859 when he was executed by the Commonwealth of Virginia as a result of his participation in the armed struggle against slavery led by John Brown. Green had met Brown at the home of Frederick Douglass. While Douglass declined to join Brown, he reports that Green said, "I believe I'll go with the old man." Shields was not one to shrink from hardship or danger. He was a man of few words, and his speech was singularly broken, but his courage and self-respect made him quite a dignified character, says Douglass, who also reported that rather than escape capture after Harper's Ferry, Green simply said he must go down to the old man. In an article on Green's trial, Stephen Lubert notes that Green's lawyer successfully argued that Dred Scott, decided just 2 years earlier, established that Green could not be charged with treason since he was not an enfranchised citizen who owed allegiance to the state. Denied the vote, Green had no obligation to be loyal to Virginia or to the U.S. With the treason charges thrown out, Green was convicted of murder and conspiracy. After the hanging, Green's body was seized for defilement by dissection by medical students from Winchester, Virginia. Lubert reports that 6 years later, the town of Oberlin created a memorial to Green and two other Brown freedom fighters from Oberlin. Quote, "These colored citizens of Oberlin," the description reads, "the heroic associates of the immortal John Brown, gave their lives for the slave. Et nunc servito etiam mortua est laus Deu." Shields Green. The life lives after the life, as a seed is void in the world as is, opening paths to worlds could be. If and as, where and when remains sown into the heavenly garment of the unknown, halfway between there and hereafter, lodged in another of time's remorseless ether, concoctions and fever. Justice is never abstract, but we abstract it at mineral peril against bodies laid waste in the pillage, hope's desperate pilgrimage.
This is an interesting poem because it's one of those, what shall I say? It's one of those poems where the this crucial footnote, which you read first, is longer than the actual poem itself. I believe you're addressing current events here. You know, this is not the poem does not strike me as unrelated to the important issues of the day, really.
Well, it's absolutely related to questions of racial justice, understood from the point of view of poetic justice, because how we regard the past is fundamental, but it also isn't the same as supporting, for example, laws that prevent racist violence or prevent large segments of young black men from going to jail or child poverty in the U.S., which is so pervasive. Much less on a global level, those same issues, you know, writ large, the distribution of the vaccine for COVID, which goes to a relatively small part of the world, global population. So inequities. I mentioned those as examples of political views that many people listening to this show would share. I meant to say them in a way that would actually seem consensual for a lot of people. Obviously, a lot of people disagree in this country, but probably those of us listening to this show who've gotten this far in the show, I would suppose that a lot of people would agree with that, and I can say things in that way. That's not what I'm trying to do in a poem. But how we understand history is a different thing. It doesn't necessarily change the views about our current policy, though it might. I was taking up the issue there, as I say in the note, and the note does become crucial, because if I could assume that people knew who the subject of that poem was, then I wouldn't necessarily have to say those things. But having really to do that work of introducing the person, it takes on a poetic task of how you frame things. And what you're saying is the difference between the long footnote, which is written, from a literary point of view, of course, it's styled in a way that's to work with that short poem. That creates a dialect between, or a dialogue between, the prose and the explanation and the framing and the poem.
Totally.
And we could never really come to a point in my mind where you wouldn't need that prose in our culture, because history is not self-evident. So the idea that the lyric poem, could stand on its own is a problem, in my view. Nothing ever stands on its own, and we always have historical framing. Some things could stand on their own because you know what they are. I mean, you could say you could talk about Napoleon. People have some idea of Napoleon-ness. But that may not require the paratext, but
right.
That's only because you have it in your mind. You might want to change that paratext, but for a lot of things, it doesn't work that way. So the issue of monuments could take different views about the controversies about any number of monuments that are being taken down. You could become emotional about wanting to pull them down, or saying, well, I grew up with that thing and it represents something that's not so bad. But at a certain point, you have to realize, I personally don't have a deep investment in almost any monuments. It's not, I didn't put them up. I'm not interested in monuments itself. So while I can go either way sometimes on some of those issues, it's the form. I love Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial, something like that. But the monuments to individual people are historically significant, but they're not things that I, in my life as a citizen or as a poetic citizen, would have put my time into erecting, right? So you could get overblown with what they are. But still, the issue was interesting to me. Who do we want to honor with the name of a school, say, or of a statue? And this was my proposal.
Yeah, totally righteous. I felt, I felt that something strong was transmitted there. We hear about these things all the time, all around the world, the monuments mostly coming down these days.
Well, then maybe we don't need monuments of that same kind. Maybe we need poems like this, So, that's what I'm saying. It's not, one could find a great figure now, the people who I admire enormously, but I'm not sure that I would put my effort into making a bronze statue of anybody. So, and it's not what I think of as public art. And a lot of people talk about, what public art could be. The past and what the public art stands for, and these statues, in every culture. In this case of this particular person, he's very young, and he's a martyr, certainly, metonymically. So like the part, this example, metonymically stands not for the famous statesman or the well-known rebel, in this case would be John Brown and Frederick Douglass, but somebody unknown. But still, we have his name, and we have something about him. And that age, in the early 20s of dying, then it metonymically links to, so many people who die.
Right.
When they're young. And so we memorialize the sacrifice and the life of people who die, in the beginning of their lives. Obviously, a lot of soldiers do, and we have monuments to those individual soldiers. This person is not exactly a soldier, right? So it's a person involved in an insurrection, but it's an insurrection that was necessary at that time. And so all insurrections, of course, are not the same. So it brings that up as well. Although, obviously, the January 6th
Christian right, Christian suprematists, white supremacists, insurrection on the Capitol is the other side of John Brown's.
Well, it's this is a poem that's in the book called Locomotion. So I felt like it was pushing something forward. I mean, there are some like travel type poems, and there's a great subway poem in this section, but still the issue here, and maybe even some of the issues that came up in the dialectics poem. I mean, it's keeping the issues alive, I guess we could say that. It's pro-generating important modes of thought, trains of thought, maybe to be more.
But you know, the poem, as you just heard it, you know, it's a very fragile poem, and it doesn't make the points that I'm making in speaking to you,
mm-hmm.
Or even in that prose thing, because it's an elegy.
Yeah. Great to hear you talking about the the historical context and the framework and necessity of the history as in the paratext. So we're going to keep moving forward to the second section. And don't ask me why I'm going from back to front, but we are.
Well, that's topsy turvy itself.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's it. Second section is titled second book. Technically, is called As I Love, and it's a quote. From the epigraph is a quote from Zhukovsky, but the poem that I mean, it would make sense for me to want to play this because you've written a poem here, another elegy, for one of my one of my great inspirations and collaborators, Cecil Taylor. And I'm going to play the poem now and come back and ask you a little bit about the form and whatnot.
A Poet Supreme, liner notes for a Cecil Taylor tribute. I've got spasmodic rhythm. You've got it illilocution as sense or remote or release. Elation Asian recombination overlay impulse propulse dash oh the pudding it pulled minded breath turn as woe inkly wiggles waiting wow. Whimsy jerked as celestial harmonics, harmonic looks so slow. You can hear the vibrations lashing against the dormers. Ich habe eine spontanum Rhythmus. Du hast Q-Sun als Sensor Modus. Oder Fragabe. Aktion. Überlebt. Atman drehen sich wie Ingli. Dormeren horan konen including but not limited to dreamt scram Becomes whiplash wish list withered wisps scrimped dreamt sprunk succession overtowed to darn dare upster fluorescent emanations showered by blooms. begegelt like a gazelle doinkbach flugs on a cornfold. Includino manau limitado. Sonhu grita benula werered pesquisado por blu u ben vindo talvas um fjord de dobra What a fluke! If I could only sing out, oh, tempimento! Creation is music. Begins here. Mined. Insurrepetitish us eruptions. Scrum pshus mired. Smeared in tenebrae. Acoustic tack till titty. Nigh unto steam pouring. Purring out of manhole. Qu'est-ce que c'est qu'un fluke? Si je n'y faisais qui chanteur commence ici dans éruption merveilleuse en bourbe induit dans la ténèbre tactilité acoustique inclination près de la vapeur qui sort de la bouche ce goût inclut mais pas limité à calculus of interpersonic questions. The making is the receiving, royaling with and against Ali hot refer. Heels in reveal in.
Here's a poem that what you can't get in the reading, hearing the reading of it, is the fact that it's got many different colors, and I presume those colors appear in the book.
Absolutely. Yeah, but you have an advanced PDF, but that's, yeah, the book is color. It's a color book.
And then you're also playing quite a bit with the capital letters in the poem, and tell, is this a kind of a scoring mechanism for you?
Well, I can give you the backstory behind that poem. John Zorn, a wonderful musician and composer and friend, asked me to write the liner notes for his Zodiac recording in tribute to the great Cecil Taylor. Three musicians doing works in tribute to Taylor, not Zorn himself. Love Cecil Taylor's music and have gone to see him in concert. In fact, I saw maybe one of his very last, if not last, concert at the Whitney Museum show. So when Zorn asked me to do that, I said, of course, I'll try to figure out what to do. But I'd also had the opportunity to see the unpublished notebooks and poems of Cecil Taylor. Now, Taylor is actually a very significant American poet, and I'm not saying that in the sense of singer-songwriter Bob Dylan, who is not particularly interested in the genre of poetry. Cecil Taylor wrote poems that were freestanding, didn't publish them that often, but they really exist separate from his music, though he sometimes reads them with musical accompaniment. They're in color. You know, I love the fact that they were in color. And I wondered, you know, why does he have these colors in them? And it made sense. But, you know, most poems are not in color. They don't use color in the way that he did. And so when John asked me to do the poem, I thought I would do it in color. And then I was able to convince the University of Chicago Press to print the book in color. There's another color image in the back of the book, but it's those two things are the reasons for the whole book being in color. And John Zorn in the CD actually prints that poem in a circle, which is great. So it's a shaped poem. It all exists. He has some incredible type designer who was able to print the whole poem in a circle. So it all fit in, you know, line lengths getting, you know, short, longer and longer and longer until in the middle, the maximum, then shorter and shorter and shorter to make a perfect circle. And I didn't want to do it that way for the book. I wanted to do it in a, it's actually kind of prose, so the lines are non-flush right form. So there's no hyphenated words, but it's not with line breaks as such. The lines can fall as they do to bring it out to the full page width. I don't know that I have, and then, you know, it's obviously I wanted to do it as something like a sound poem, as you could hear from the reading. If you read the poem yourself, you wouldn't necessarily sound out the syllables and the different sounds the way I do when I'm performing it, but that's the advantage of a performance. But of course, I wanted to somehow think through the way in which Cecil Taylor's music works with dissonance and breaking melodic patterns down and creating reverberation and overlay. In his poems, they're really not quite like what I do. So what I write isn't really like Cecil Taylor's writing, but is influenced by it to the extent that it's in color and aspects and other aspects too, but actually by the music and aspects of the way he uses what sometimes could be understood as noise to create melodic patterns and resonances. And there are a lot of very, you know, even though I'm talking about the form and the texture and the style, there's an enormous amount of very specific commentary and thinking in and around Taylor that exists in the vocabulary and the phrases and so on. He may be within the sound poetry tradition. Maybe not. Maybe I'm in the sound poetry tradition. Maybe not. Sound poetry, I used to say always, there's two kinds of poetry, sound poetry and unsound poetry. but it pushes, you talk about, Zukofsky talks about poetry as being the lower limit speech, upper limit music. So what happens when words become music? I would say if you're just operating as I do in that poem, at the level of things that are phonemic, that have to do with sounds that are made within speech or to create verbal language, but without any musical accompaniment. So it's a simple distinction, although more complicated than it may at first seem. But nonetheless, there are problems with that way of putting it. But that to me still remains within the realm of poetry rather than music, that the materials remain essentially verbal and that it's being performed by the voice, human voice, without accompaniment, without sounds that are external to that voice. So within that, the history of sound poetry, you know, is enormously significant. I'm also interested in overlaying what often are divided lines of what these histories are. So I'm not interested in a pure line of anything, really. These traditions mix and they match and they come from different places. So we don't talk necessarily of jazz and sound poetry the same, but I do, and I write about this in Objectivist Blues, one of my essays, and talking about blues there, I talk a lot about the blues and the blues form and, you know, the difference between Handy and Charlie Patton, where I would put Charlie Patton more on the noise side. So, I mean, jazz was to some degree associated with noise as people heard it early on, especially in its international manifestations. You know, noise is always problematic to me. It's a little like the word dogma. People say, well, that's noise when you're telling the truth. Yeah. And they say what they're, when they're doing their noise act, we say, oh, that's, I disagree with it, but it's content. So a lot of the, what we hear in the mass media is noise. And when you try to push against it, then you're accused of producing noise. So I'm very wary of the term noise as I'm using it. But as a sonic effect, it's just, you can't.
No, I love that part.
Noise,
of it.
Just an expression means?
You do this thing where you're translating the diacritical marks or you know, in the various things, and that was fun. I mean, it's fun to compare the text with the sound.
Well, and there's also
it's improvisation, Charles.
And translated. Yes, absolutely. Improvisation and performance. Performance is always improvisation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's fantastic. I was, again, happy to see this poem and glad it's out there. And people can hear it as well as read it when the book is released. And that's coming up in the next couple of weeks, right?
Right. Should be by the out at the end of April.
Charles, I've enjoyed speaking with you so much. I wish we could go on and on, but the program is only an hour. So I have to we'll have to cut this off. I'm going to thank you and remind listeners that they've been listening to Charles Bernstein on Poet Radio and WGXC. For those of you who don't know Charles' work as well, you can go to Penn Sound, which is an archive of poetry at UPenn. And I'm pretty much every recording that's been made of Charles Bernstein's probably appears there. Is that right?
Anyone that I know of.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing archive of Charles' work. It's been a great pleasure to have him on the program at long last. So thanks so much, Charles. And we're going to head out of the program listening to some of the poems on the first section of the book, Cognitive Dissidence. Didn't really have a chance to talk about cognitive dissidence, but...
heard it.
Yeah, I guess we can let the listeners... let the listeners to decide what it is for themselves.
Shelter in place. It's no go from the get-go. Strumming a mordant medley from the old days when we danced with abandon. Now we are abandoned. God's silence deafens us to each other. And the fiddlers diddle a familiar tune. Familiar and deadly. Wake up, say those still small voices. The anthro obscene is playing just north of here. And this is just a taste of what's to come.